Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Day two of the Obama Energy Palooza on the broadcast. Today, what people really think about what he wants. Some Freakonomics Radio and a little bit of college hoops as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 22nd of March. Good as always to have you with us. The White House Energy Roadshow made a stop in Cushing, Oklahoma today. The president was talking energy independence and the Keystone XL pipeline at the crossroads of the American oil network. Cushing is where prices for U.S. crude get settled. Today, by the way, $105.47 a barrel. But as the president acknowledged when we talked to him yesterday, it's a certain derivative petroleum product that consumers are really interested in. And so for today's attitude check, our partnership with Gallup, what Americans really want out of a White House energy policy.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's here with us every week to talk. Frank, it's good to have you back again.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So we, as you know, had the president on the broadcast yesterday. We went out to Nevada to talk to him, asked him about gas and energy prices and what he can do to get those prices off the $4 a gallon mark. He said, you know what? There is no silver bullet. And then he said this.
If we've only got 2% of the world's oil reserves and we're using 20% of the world's oil, then the math is not going to add up unless we also develop the kinds of new technologies that are represented by this solar panel field out here.
Well, so the question is, what do Americans think? Do we want drill, baby, drill, which the administration has been doing to some degree, or do they want renewables?
In some ways, they want it all.
We're Americans, and we want it all. Yeah.
Actually, the president has said that. You know, he said there's no silver bullet. We need to do a lot of different things. And sure enough, that's where the public comes down. Let me tell you why I say that. Kai, when we do give people a choice, should we emphasize oil and gas production or alternative energy sources such as solar and wind, just a straight trade-off, it's 59-34 in favor of the latter. So clearly,
Say that again. 59-34 in favor of?
Of the alternative energy sources such as solar and wind. So that would fit right in from what President Obama told you in that interview. Americans tilt that direction.
I don't know if buy, but do they appreciate the role of market forces in oil and that we're in a global economy when it comes to buying crude oil?
Boy, that's a very highfalutin question. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't asked the public in exactly those words, but we did ask the public, do you think that there is something that the president and Congress can do that will actually affect the cost of gasoline?
See, now that's 65% great.
You said yes.
You knew what the question should be, even if I asked it wrong.
Right.
But anyway, go ahead. 65% said yes.
That's right. And then we also said, should Congress and the president, and we put the word immediately in there, take immediate action to try to control the price of gas? And 85% said yes on that. Hmm. So even though if President Obama, as you talk to him, in his heart of hearts, knows that he really can't do a lot, he's absolutely doing the right thing to try to talk about it because the public expects him and Congress to at least take some actions or look like they're doing something to try to affect the price of gas.
Quickly, Frank, on the way out, the president announced he's going to fast-track the bottom half of the XL pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, the part that goes from Cushing, Oklahoma, which is where he was today. Do we want that? Do Americans want more oil pipelines?
They do. A big majority of Americans said yes, approve the XL pipeline.
This is fascinating. So that bit you said up at the top, that Americans want everything, we really do. We want the XL pipeline, we want renewables, we want the whole smash.
That's right, and we also want apple pie and motherhood.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with them every week is called Attitude Check. If you want to know more about the polling they do, you can find out about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
Good talking to you.
On Wall Street today, well, what if I just say could have been better? Traders seem to be worried about China and Europe and factories here, but really, they're a skittish bunch, so you never actually know, do you? We'll have the details such as they are when we do the numbers. The visuals for the president's speech today in Cushing, Oklahoma were pretty good. Big green pipes that will eventually become part of the Keystone XL pipeline. Neat little pivot, actually, from the acres of solar panels that he and I were sitting amidst yesterday. Unlike solar, though, Keystone is controversial, a political flashpoint for environmentalists who want it stopped before it starts, and Republicans in Congress who want the jobs it could bring. Commentator Bill McKibben says the president's all-of-the-above energy strategy, oil and renewables, is great, but it's missing a certain something.
The president made what could have been a landmark speech today in Cushing, Oklahoma. It came amidst a completely unprecedented March heat wave. 3,500 high temperature records this week. Cities like Chicago were the hottest since record keeping began in the 19th century. It came on the tail of another record, 2011's for multi-billion dollar weather disasters in America. In other words, if there was a moment for talking about global warming, this would be it. But the president didn't. Instead, he focused on his all-of-the-above energy policy, about how America has drilled a record number of oil and gas wells during his administration, how we've laid enough pipeline to encircle the earth, about how he wants to lay some more, in particular, the southern half of the Keystone XL pipeline, which will bring oil from Canada's tar sands to refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. But all of the above is definitely not a coherent energy policy. Burning all the oil you can and then putting up a solar panel or even a solar farm, it's like drinking six martinis at lunch and then downing a vitamin water on the way to your car. You're still drunk, you've just got a few extra vitamins in you. Think about it. If a presidential candidate said they had an all-of-the-above foreign policy where every other nation was an equal ally, they'd be thought silly and dangerous, and they would be. But with energy, with $5 gas looming, it apparently still seems politic to insist that we need never make a choice.
Bill McKibben is the head of the environmental group 350.org. His most recent book is called Earth. If you've got some thoughts to share, send them along. We're at marketplace.org, also on Facebook as well. President Obama's health care law turns 2 years old tomorrow. There probably aren't going to be any celebrations, though, because Monday is going to be a much bigger day for the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court starts 3 days of hearings, key parts of which will be about the most contentious part of the law, something called the individual mandate, the requirement that everybody purchase health insurance. In essence, whether the government can force people to buy something. The Obama administration maintains the law is indeed constitutional, and they point to a very specific clause in the Constitution, the Interstate Commerce Clause, in their defense. To explain, Marketplace's Gregory Warner took a walk in Philadelphia.
I'm walking onto the Ben Franklin Bridge that connects Pennsylvania and New Jersey. There's a footpath.
I've always wanted to do this.
With me is Ted Ruger.
Well, I'm Ted Ruger. I teach health law and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania.
And Ruger is an expert on something called the Interstate Commerce Clause in the Constitution. It's the clause that allows the federal government to regulate economic activity between states.
I mean, we're walking across a bridge that very tangibly connects two states here, and we can all see that. But we're talking about an issue, health insurance, that in somewhat less visible but no less important ways is connected among all the 50 states.
For instance, your insurance policy pays for drugs and medical devices that cross state lines. Insurance money is pooled between people in different states.
The choice to buy insurance is an economic choice that reverberates across state lines.
Reverberates just like these tractor trailers. And the law is firm on that point.
But so too is the choice to forgo insurance, roll the dice, if you will.
And this is the question before the Supreme Court. If the government can use the same power it uses to regulate these trucks to compel you to buy health insurance. Because when it comes to medical care, no man is an island. If I don't have health insurance and I get sick, I can still go to the hospital, get treatment, and those costs will be passed on to other people. the uninsured cost $43 billion in 2008.
So the choice that looks like it's your own choice could very well reverberate in ways that burden others.
The government argues that everybody needs to share that burden by paying in now, even when they're healthy. So health care is there for anyone who gets sick, just like this bridge is here for Ted Ruger and I to walk to New Jersey. Or so we thought.
Is this a commercial project?
No, no, I'm not doing a story about the bridge. We're just chatting.
Yeah, but you're still using the bridge.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for health insurance.
I know, but you got to get in touch with Ed Kasuba. You know Ed?
So we got off the bridge. And then I went to talk to Lee Casey at Baker & Hostetler. He's one of the lawyers that originally brought this case in the lower courts on behalf of 26 states. Casey says that not buying insurance is just one of many personal decisions that have an economic impact.
The fact that, you know, I skipped breakfast this morning has an effect that ripples through the economy, but that doesn't mean Congress can regulate that. My decision, quote unquote, not to have breakfast.
The Interstate Commerce Clause, he says, only allows the government to regulate economic activities.
Activities, not decisions, not personal, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that.
In Casey's view, if the federal government is allowed to make us buy insurance, it can make us buy anything. Now, some lawyers have pointed out that Congress did make people buy a musket and bullets. This was 1792. But in the words of the appellate court, quote, there's a difference between drafting a citizen to join the military and forcing him to respond to a price quote from Aetna.
The case law has never gone so far as to suggest that someone's personal decision not to enter commerce somehow gives Congress the ability then to force you into commerce so it can then regulate you.
The government responds by arguing that health insurance is different. That market only works if enough healthy people contribute to the pool before they think they need it. Tom Baker is an insurance law expert at the University of Pennsylvania.
You know, we need a really big group for insurance to work. And to have a really big group, you have to have people thrown together in some way that they can't exit.
The arguments continue through Wednesday, but it'll be late June before we know if the Supreme Court is willing to let the feds put a lock on that door. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
We have arrived at that marker of springtime, that harbinger of warmer weather to come. Yes, the Sweet 16 of the men's NCAA basketball tournament. I know. Isn't it great? Play resumes this evening with most of the Cinderellas knocked out. Schools like Belmont and Norfolk State or Lehigh. But the publicity of merely being in the big dance means big dollars even if you don't get to the Final Four. Jim Burris reports.
Few expected 13-seed Ohio University to make the Sweet 16, but the Bobcats have.
When your team shines on a national level, it draws attention to the university.
That's Ohio University's president, Roderick McDavis. He says for 2 weeks now, his school's been basking in media attention. It's perfect timing. The university's nearing the end of a $450 million capital campaign.
We believe this will help our alumni to make generous contributions to the university. That's what we're betting on.
But even teams that didn't make it this far expect big returns. Take Murray State University. Last week, Murray State fans packed a Louisville hotel to send off their team in the NCAA's first round. This scene isn't unheard of. Over the past decade, the rural Western Kentucky school has been to the tournament five times. This year, every time someone like ESPN's Dick Vitale mentioned Murray State,
let's go Racers, baby!
It translated into a bit of this. Randy Dunn is Murray State's president.
From when we really started to get a national attention right before the holidays up through the end of our run in the tournament, that's probably going to be worth somewhere in the vicinity of $10 million.
Casey Brown is with Cision Global Analyst. He tracks stuff like this. Brown says success in sports can benefit everything from bookstore sales to government relations to alumni diplomas.
Every alum would see an increase in the value of the degree that they got from Murray State.
And Brown says intense coverage can even change a university's image. That's not a bad thing, considering Ohio University was recently named the number one party school in the nation. In Louisville, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, this is a violent book. This is a violent series, and it's about children.
Which is where the marketing people make their money. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so there was some more fretting on Wall Street today about a global slowdown. The Dow Industrials raced 0.6%, 78 points, closed at 13,046. The NASDAQ wiped away 0.4%, 12 points, 3,063. The S&P 500 deleted 0.75%, 10 points, finished at 1392. On the financial front, Morgan Stanley and Citigroup both unloaded 2.33%. Bank of America down 2.25%. Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase each took off about 1% or so. Record holiday shipping bumped up profits at FedEx, but the stock took a different direction, down 3.5% today. Kansas City Southern, in the business of transporting things by rail, backtracked 3%. Union Pacific reversed 2%. Big day for a couple of IPOs. Exact Target, that's an email targeting software company, closed 32% higher than it opened. Ventiv, a data processing firm, closed up 14%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.28%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for February. The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee holds a panel discussion on mobile phone wallets. That's payments made with your cell phone. And let's not just talk about the weather, let's celebrate it. Tomorrow is World Meteorological Day. The theme, powering our future with weather, climate, and water. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every 2 weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Thank you, Kai. I want to talk to you about this economic buzzword these days, innovation.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, we've got to innovate our way back to greatness. Do you know who's got the most room for improvement in the innovation field?
You and me, baby.
Well, that's the sad truth, isn't it? But if you look at the data on patents, okay, patent filing, it turns out that women are responsible for only about 7.5% of all patents filed.
I mean, that's amazing. That's 93-something percent for men. That's ridiculous.
Well, 92-something, but, you know, I know math is not your strong suit.
I'm a math guy.
Sorry?
Has to be science and engineering, right, and the lack of women therein?
Yeah, that's a very sensible first thought. Not a bad one, Kai. You're doing better. But it's a surprising fact. The fact is that even women with science and engineering degrees aren't much more likely to file a patent than women with other degrees. Now, Jenny Hunt, who's an economist at Rutgers, she says that one big factor is that you just don't find a lot of women in the kind of sweet spot jobs within an industry that lead to a lot of patent filing.
Men are more likely to be in jobs involving design work or development work, so the D and the R&D. And even within given fields of study, women are less likely to be in those jobs, and that also reduces their patenting.
Now, you know, this idea, Kai, actually explains a lot of the male-female wage gap across the board in different industries, whether it's business or medicine or education. Women end up gravitating toward the lower-paying jobs within those fields. So, you know, say a general practice physician versus a surgeon.
Yeah. Well, all right. So is that women being steered away from those jobs? Is that subtle discrimination? Or is it women making the career and family choice that men seldom make? I mean, there's a lot going on, right?
It is all of the above, certainly, probably most of the latter. A lot of it is by choice, but not all of it. Some of it is discrimination. But the bigger point that Jenny Hunt is making about the patent data is that by having such a low rate of female patenting, even within the science and engineering fields, the U.S. is missing an opportunity. So she argues that closing the male-female patenting gap in science and engineering would have a dramatic effect on the economy, that it might lift GDP per capita by as much as 2.7%.
Wow, which is a huge jump given the way the economy is growing these days, or not, right?
Massive.
How do we get there?
It's interesting. There's a lot of research showing that men are bigger risk takers than women. Now, I talked to an economics professor in Britain. Her name is Alison Booth. And she had cooked up an experiment to look into this male-female risk gap. She randomly assigned a bunch of first-year economics students to either single-sex classes or co-ed classes. So there were all female groups, all male groups, mm-hmm. and mixed, all randomly selected. Then she had each of the students take a test to determine their baseline level of risk aversion. And then after 8 weeks of class, she gave all the students the same test. And here's what she learned.
We found that the girls who'd been in single-sex groups all the way through the term were behaving the same as the boys who were in single-sex groups. So it was only the girls who were in the coeducational groups who were making fewer risky choices.
That's amazing. 2 months away from boys or men and women want more risk.
Women seem to compete better when they're competing against women. And yeah. once you bring men into the equation, they kind of dial it down a little bit. That's what we're seeing in a lot of the research.
That's wild. So get me back to patents and innovation. How do we get there?
Well, you know, here's one thought. If I'm a Google or a GE or the U.S. government and I truly want to maximize my resources, really get the most out of all my employees, I might try something that's so old-fashioned that it'll strike a lot of people as truly repugnant. I might actually segregate my workforce. I might actually let my sharpest women set up shop separately away from the men and just see what kind of wonderful stuff they can produce on their own.
You know, I was going to give you a hard time, but it'd be actually interesting. I don't know. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, Kai. Thanks very much.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com.
There's a movie opening tomorrow you might have heard of, The Hunger Games. You've seen the ads probably, right? It's based on a young adult book series. It's got a huge following already, the movie does. In fact, advanced ticket sales broke the record set by another tween favorite you have probably also heard of, The Twilight Saga. As it happens, Lionsgate owns both of those franchises, and it's banking on Hunger Games being its next monster franchise. But with a plot that involves kids killing each other, marketing has been tricky. As Sandin Totten from KPCC in Pasadena explains.
The world of the Hunger Games is grim. People are poor, starving, and oppressed. They're ruled by a rich elite who watch a yearly sporting event where children are forced to fight to the death.
Welcome and happy Hunger Games.
You're stronger than they are.
There's 24 of us, Gale. Only one comes out.
No! Take care of them, Gale. Whatever you do, don't let them starve.
Pretty dark stuff for a tween flick. It helps that there's a love triangle in the movie, and that the cast is really hot.
Oh, yeah.
Yes! They're so hot! They're so hot!
Right next to us!
Meet 8th graders Emma Obregon, Mackenzie Mora, and Michaela Minig. All three of them have read the books.
She read it, and then she read it, and then I read it.
So we all told each other.
They've seen the trailer.
I, like, watched it, like, a billion times.
They are so ready for the movie.
We're addicted. We're obsessed.
The obsession is nationwide. More than 20 million copies of the books are in print. They're a hit with girls and boys, and the movie is projected to bring in over $100 million this opening weekend. Could The Hunger Games be, dare I say it, bigger than Twilight?
I think it has a really, really, really good chance.
That's Susan Ganelius, marketing expert and chief executive of Key Splash Creative. Twilight has made $2.5 billion. A lot of it comes from shirts, posters, Twilight perfume, and other merchandise. Susan Ganelius says it's not hard to sell a romance with sexy vampires and hunky werewolves.
But The Hunger Games is dangerous territory in some ways just because, you know, this is a violent book. This is a violent series, and it's about children.
So how do you sell a story full of poverty, starvation, and teen-on-teen killings? Very carefully, says Paula Kupfer. She's in charge of merchandise and cross-promotion for the Hunger Games movie.
The unknown of, you know, how is this story going to translate and how are customers going to react was definitely top of mind for many of the brands that we reached out to.
Some didn't reach back. So her team focused on the world and the characters in the movie, not the action. You won't see a single fight scene on any of the products. You will see a Hunger Games branded laptop from Microsoft, a Nook e-reader deal with Barnes & Noble, even a doll from Mattel based on the main character. Don't worry, she won't be your typical Barbie. And of course, there will be the usual t-shirts, posters, notebooks. Some tie-ins, though, just won't work.
A Happy Meal would never in 100 years work for the Hunger Games. It just wouldn't.
Lionsgate's Paula Kupfer hopes that once marketers see the movie and the money it makes, they'll change their minds. With three sequels already in the works, they'll have plenty of opportunity to get on board. In Los Angeles, I'm Shannon Totten for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is kind of mind-boggling when you think of it. Shares of a company called Ohio Art are up 141% since yesterday morning. 141%. Why, you ask? No, not for some amazing new breakthrough, not for some incredible new product. No, just because it has the great good fortune to be the parent company of Etch-A-Sketch, which got all kinds of buzz yesterday when it became the political prop of the day in the GOP primaries. All I'm saying is, never trust the markets, man. They don't know what they're doing. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow erased 0.6%. That's 78 points. The NASDAQ wiped away 0.4%. 12 points. The S&P 500 deleted 0.75%. That's 10 points. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.